Hello!
Hey guys, it's Arden Cho.
Hey, I'm Holland Roden.
Hello, this is Ian Bowen.
Hey you guys, this is Melissa Poncio.
Hi, I'm Lyndon Ashby.
Hi, I'm Dylan Sprayberry.
This is Megan Tandy.
This is Tyler Posey, and you are listening to Not Another.
Not Another.
Not Another.
This is Not Another Teen Wolf Podcast.
Yes, it is!
Oh.
Woo!
Hey, this is Jeff Davis. You're listening to Not Another Teen Wolf Podcast, my favorite podcast in the world.
Everyone, welcome back to Not Another Teen Wolf Podcast. You may not have heard from us in a while because we've been very tired, to be frank, but Teen Wolf has been on hiatus, and so we take a little break at this time of year as well to focus on other things, etc., and we'll talk about some of those things in one moment. But we're back with a hiatus episode. This is our episode 127 of our Teen Wolf podcast, and we're going to be talking today about a subject that has been somewhat prominent in Teen Wolf and is also very prominent in a couple of the other bits of media that we've sort of been dedicating our time to recently. And so we wanted to do a bit of a compare and contrast of that and how it may affect Teen Wolf in the future, given what may or may not be coming up in season six. So I, as always, am Natalie, one of your hosts. Our other host today is Karen, the co-host and leader of Not Another Teen Wolf podcast. Hello, Karen.
Hi.
Hi. So, yeah, we're going to be having a big moral discussion today. That's interesting.
Yeah, I think it's going to be kind of intense.
Yeah, hopefully not too intense. And hopefully we'll be able to think of some clever, deep things to say. So what we're going to be talking about today is the culpability of a character when they do things outside of their own control, basically, which is something that's happened several times in Teen Wolf and something that's been prominent in, as you'll see in a moment, a couple of things that we've been thinking a lot about lately. If you want to get in touch with us, you can always reach us on our Twitter, which is NATWpodcast. Our email address is natwpodcast@gmail.com. Our Tumblr is notanotherteenwolfpodcast.tumblr.com, and our Instagram is natwpodcast as well. You can also check out any Teen Wolf news and features as they come on hyperball.com, our parent website, though as it is the off-season, the show has been very quiet in terms of what's going on with their production, which is, again, something we'll probably tack on the end with a little bit of a news segment. Spoiler alert, the news is that there is no news, and we're finding that a little bit weird. Well, it's true. Is it not true?
That is absolutely true.
Yeah. So I guess to start off with, just before we get into the discussion, yesterday, June 5th, we're recording this very early in the morning on June 6th. So yesterday, June 5th, was the fifth anniversary of Teen Wolf premiering on MTV as well. So we could have done a whole other episode with like top million different top fives, but I sort of didn't really plan that well. We were meant to do this episode a couple of weeks ago, but we both got sick. So, yeah, any thoughts about Teen Wolf being on the air for 5 years?
I mean, pretty crazy. Pretty awesome. It's cool seeing everybody reflect on it. Like, Colton tweeted some things out, and Keanu tweeted some things out, and
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you see that Alyssa posted a picture of us dead on the floor of Beacon Hills High School?
No.
Yeah, on Instagram? That was her 5 years of Teen Wolf memory, is us dead on the floor of Teen Wolf.
I love her.
So that was nice. That was a good thing that's happened. But yeah, 5 years. You know, 80 episodes out of 100 that they've aired, like so far, which is crazy. Like, I don't know. I sort of don't really fathom that it has been that long. I think because the seasons are so short, so you don't really think of it being like a whole year's worth of time. But yeah, congratulations to Teen Wolf for being on the air for 5 years. And yeah, we're sort of awaiting season 6, which we thought we'd know when it was coming out by now, but we don't. So I guess it'll be here soon. I don't know. Soon. Okay. So the actual thing that we wanted to talk about today, and this sort of came up because I was kicking this idea around as a comparison article, which I still may write depending on how inspired I am by this conversation, about the way that a narrative, like not necessarily like a fandom or not necessarily like you're going to jail, but like the way that the narrative and the characters around a character treat someone when that character, their physical body has been used to perform actions either by mind control or possession or something like that to do really bad things. Whether it's because they're brainwashed, whether it's because they're like completely literally possessed by another being, whether it's that, you know, a fundamental part of their functioning was taken away from them in some way. But it either they are a backseat driver in their own mind, or their own mind has completely been replaced by something else, and that they are doing terrible things. Their hands and eyes and mouth and, you know, whatever other parts of their body are used to do damage, do these things, and it's not really within their control at all. And we wanted to sort of talk about, like, how responsible a character is when that happens, like how we feel about that, and also how the narrative of various stories acts like someone is responsible in that circumstance, whether they are held responsible by either actual justice in the movie or whether they're, like, punished by the narrative, whether it's just through the writing or something, like they don't get to be happy or they have to leave or something like that. You know, how are they held accountable and should they be? So, yeah, I mean, just first things first, do you have any particular, like, thoughts on this before we get into it? It may be that we talk about this and you have a different idea by the end of it. But right now, Karen, like, how do you feel about this kind of topic, I guess?
I think from an audience's point of view, I think that it is meant to be fairly obvious that the character who has done these things but is not in control should not be held accountable. And I believe that. I mean, we'll get into the various examples, but through each of them, I'm like, yeah, you know, it's not their fault what's happening to them. But what I think is really interesting is when you go into the show or the movie and you look at it from the point of view of other characters who might not understand what's going on. Specifically, I guess, like Sheriff, for example, you know, well, he's not him. Maybe somebody who is not aware that something supernatural is happening. You know, how are they supposed to respond to that? They believe that it's the person doing it. And I think that's an interesting perspective to have on it. But for me, as an audience viewer who, like, understands what's going on, I don't know if you ever really can hold them accountable. But it'd be interesting to see if that does change as we discuss.
I think it's kind of like the character, nearly always the character themselves has guilt about it. And it's sort of a matter of whether that's, you know, whether they're able to overcome that. And there's also the fact of, like, well, these actions were done like, do we just say that no one's responsible? Like, and if even if no one, even if we don't believe that that character is culpable, like, you know, like, does just the sheer act of doing it mean that, like, other people should hold them responsible, or should they just be like, yeah, whatever, that's fine? Sort of the visceral, you know, outside of the control feelings about someone, like, you know, knowing that that person did that, even if you also know that they didn't really do it, if you know what I mean. It's going to be a bit hard to describe, but we've got some more specific examples, which are much, you know, much clearer. So Teen Wolf has a lot of examples of this, which is something that we'll get into in a minute after we talk about a couple of the other big ones that have been, you know, really prominent in our lives currently, I guess. But most notably in Teen Wolf, you've got sort of Jackson in season 2 as the Kanema, Styles in season 3B as the Nagitsune, Kira as she struggles with the Kitsune and has more and more actions of, you know, not her own as well, and then Mason being, I guess, possessed by the Beast and doing stuff as the Beast before he turns into someone else entirely, which... we'll get into those in a minute and sort of see how Teen Wolf has treated those characters in terms of culpability. But the two major cases that we're looking at the moment, which is the reason I sort of started thinking about this topic in general, is currently at the moment in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which we're following on Rewatchable at the moment. Karen and I are both super fans on that podcast, which is where we've sort of been hanging out while Teen Wolf has been off. But we're currently up to the part where Angel has come back to Sunnydale and to being alive and to being himself as Angel after Buffy was forced to kill him in the season 2 finale, even though he had his soul back, because the ritual that Angelus started to end the world had already begun, and that the only solution was to kill Angel or Angelus, that body, that person's blood and body, in order to save the world. And it's very dramatic, very sad. But Angel is back, and he's sort of crazed because he's been in, like, a hell dimension for hundreds of years in torture in hell. And there's this sort of issue, at least for a good few episodes, where Buffy hides the fact that he's back, and when the others find out, they react quite badly to it because they are really troubled by being around Angel, given what he did as Angelus. And it's a really difficult call to make, especially in this case, because with Angel, it's not really as simple as, oh, he was brainwashed or possessed. It's sort of, it's him without his soul, which is a different kind of situation, which I believe Vampire Diaries has something similar, like they can get rid of their humanity or something like that. I haven't seen that show, I'm told. That this is something that happens, like, a lot on Vampire Diaries, and that apparently no one is ever held accountable. They're like, that's fine. That's when he was, like, not, you know, that's when he had his humanity turned off. That doesn't count. He's fine. We still trust him. With Buffy, with Angel, especially in this period, because, you know, Angelus killed Giles's girlfriend. He attacked and tortured, like, a lot of her friends, and they really struggle. They're really angry at her for keeping the fact that he's back a secret, you know, and just meaning that he is around them, like meaning that they risk being around him and they risk the dangers of, especially because Buffy and Angel get back together, like romantically, like they've tried to not be, and then they're like, no, we really can't not be together. And so they don't trust that it won't, like, sort of happen all over again. I'm not really sure kind of what to ask here, except for that, like, because we've talked about it a lot on Rewatchable, obviously, but with Angelus and Angel, like, would you sort of categorize this in the same sort of, I guess, culpability argument as people being possessed and people being mind controlled and stuff like that? Like, how would you define Angel's sort of culpability and change of personality, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does fall in line the same way that the others do. I mean, the situation is different, but the point is that he has changed. You know, there is a factor that has been changed, and now he acts a different way. And I think, you know, when it first happens, he didn't necessarily know that sleeping with Buffy would lead to him losing his soul. And I think because of that, because it wasn't like intentional, you can kind of categorize it in the same way. Mm. What I find really interesting is that, like I was saying before, as an audience member, you know, you want to root for Angel. He is a good guy. And when he loses his soul, he becomes a terrible, terrible person. But when he gains it back, you want him to stay good. And you want him and Buffy, you know, to be together, or at least to be friends. Like, I don't think anyone hates him so much that that they wouldn't want that, at least, you know, for him to stay good. But it's the other characters who you can't necessarily blame for their reactions. You know, Giles was tortured. When he looks at Angel's face, he sees Angelus, and you can't fault him for that. And even Xander, for, you know, as much as his views tend to be problematic, he's got a point. How do we know that this will never happen again? Even if they don't sleep together, how do we know that Angel will not lose his soul
like
again?
Like, he might have a really good ice cream or something, you know? Like,
right. Yeah. I mean, some Ben and Jerry's, like, you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah. So it is, like, it's very much, it's in those few episodes, like, consequences and, like, the ones surrounding that in the sort of the first 10 episodes of the season. Yeah, the discovery that Angel's there, the sort of the conversations that people have with Buffy, and even Angel's actions himself, he's kind of like, at first he's quite unstable, and then he's kind of like, I should leave, and Buffy, you know, is sort of helping him to recover. He's very, very traumatized. And I don't know, it's sort of just a really unfair situation all around, I guess, because he's sort of in this position where, yeah, everyone knows how volatile he is, and it's not even like, oh, there's no one else to blame. It's not even like, oh, you were possessed, you were tortured, you know, you were brainwashed. It's, this is like you without a collar on, you know, I guess, if you know what I mean. Like, what on earth, like, this is in you, this is something of who you are. And, I don't know, it's interesting, sort of, that there's no real solution to it, and it goes on to amends as well, in which, due to the first evil coming to torture him, like, you know, about all of the bad things he's done as Angelus, that he, like, tries to kill himself. Like, that's where he ends up. That he ends up just being so plagued by his actions as Angelus that he tries to kill himself. And it's just this circumstance of, at the end of the day, like, that someone is, or that he is responsible for what he has done, or he holds himself responsible. And then Buffy kind of comes in and has the big, you know, speech about how he's good and stuff like that. And I think that the narrative of the show, like, the show is showing us the first evil, who is evil, being like, you know, you did all this, it's your fault, you're terrible. So this is the bad guy saying this. And then the hero of the show, Buffy, saying, you know, no, that's not how it is. Like, you can always fight for it and whatever. I'm not going to recite it exactly. I guess when it comes down to it is, like, all of these characters, or at least often with these characters, you get this guilt and this culpability of, well, they are being held accountable for their actions in some way. And I don't know, do you think that is fair? Like, obviously the perspective, there are so many delicate perspectives, like you said with Giles, you know, not being able to handle Angel, but that's not Angel's fault, it's Angelus's fault, like, and it's all really a mess. But do you think that those characters who've done this kind of thing, like in this case, you know, Angel, you know, do you think that he would have the right to leave town and go, like, live on a ranch and just be happy, like, and not like, have to make up for anything that he did? Or, like, do you think it's the matter of, like, you know, if he wants to be around the people he wronged, he has to make up for what he did? Or should they just flat out, you know, in a world where everyone just goes on logic, like, should they just forgive him and be like, okay, Angel, we know it wasn't you, even though it really hurts to think about the fact that you killed my girlfriend?
Yeah. See, that situation is so difficult and complicated and layered because he could leave. And I think that he would make some people happy that way. And I think that he might even feel better because of it, because he won't be around Buffy and her friends and he won't risk hurting them again. He could also stay and try to make it up to them, but that might not be what those people want him to do. I think you have to take in consideration their thoughts and feelings on it too. And not that I fault her for it, but I do think that in a way Buffy is being very selfish by wanting him to stick around. And I think she wants him to make it up to the others, or she wants the others to see that he is capable of doing that. It's all very, very difficult. And I think in this situation in particular, because what happened was not his fault. It was an accident. Mm. He can try to make it up to them, but will he ever be able to do that? Because there's still the chance that it might happen again. And I think that's what everybody's worried about.
Yeah, and like in the second half of the season where we're up to so far, kind of like they're together and everyone's like kind of okay with it. Like he shows up and they're not like, get thee away, you know, kind of thing. They're somewhat chill with him. Which I guess is nice, like that the trust is sort of regained. But the show definitely does address it. Like, his culpability, like, is definitely addressed by the narrative in that has, you know, we have episodes of him trying to kill himself, and we have episodes of, you know, Giles giving Buffy this lecture about how selfish and cruel she was to have put Giles into that circumstance, you know, by keeping Angel around and that kind of thing. So, ultimately, like, do you feel good about the way Buffy handles or is handling, there's still lots of Buffy to come, you know, with Angel and his culpability for being Angelus?
Yeah, I do. I think that it's going okay right now. I mean, these people are only human, and Buffy wants him to stick around, you know, like she can't help her feelings for him. And it comes down to the fact that Angel, with his soul, is a very good person. He is not only doing the right thing, but he is capable of helping just as much as Buffy is. You know, he's got his own superpowers, and I think that he is an asset to the team. Do they have to risk, you know, him being around and the chance of something like this happening again? Yes. But to contrast it with something like The Vampire Diaries, where they choose to turn off their humanity.
Really?
They choose to turn it off.
Why? Why would anyone choose that?
Because when you're a vampire in The Vampire Diaries, your feelings are enhanced. And when something bad happens, they react to it in a much bigger way than a regular person would. And it's much easier to just turn off the humanity and not feel guilty about anything. So they literally just, you know, turn it off. They just flip a switch in their head. I would be much more worried hanging around those vampires than Angel.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, yeah. No thanks. That's crazy. So, yeah, I mean, basically, it's really, yeah, for me, it's what it stands, what it comes to is that, like, and how I feel in this circumstance, and I sort of want to try and hang on to this in order to apply it to the next thing, which I don't think I'm going to be able to do, but I will try, which is that Angel has 100% the right to be, like, happy and to go and have his ranch and his ice cream and whatever he wants. he has the right to not have any guilt or upset about this. Other people who were hurt by Angelus also have the right to be super, super, super traumatized by this person existing, if you know what I mean. However, there's no, like, those two things don't equal each other, if you know what I mean. There's no third party to sort of point out and be like, this is your fault. But it's also not really, like... Like, both of those parties have the right, like, the right to their full range of feelings in this circumstance with no one actually to blame. And that's really difficult because those two things conflict so badly. Like, Angel, Angel has the right not to be culpable. But other people have the right to be like, well, no one else is culpable and it was you that did it. I don't know how fair it is. Like, in my world, I would really like to think that I could be like, I rationally understand that you were also a victim of this circumstance. And I think that I would be, and I think that the characters in Buffy do come to feel that about Angel, at least where they're at now, if you know what I mean. Like, Giles isn't banishing him from the library, you know? They're kind of okay now. But the initial reaction, at least, is definitely visceral, I guess. And so it's really difficult to kind of pin down what's fair, I guess. It's not so much what's right that I'm concerned with here, because they both do have the right. It's to pin down what is fair for someone to act like, if that makes sense. Like, does Angel have the right... Like, is it fair for Angel to dance around being like, I'm happy, I'm dating Buffy again, even though it might mean that I get so happy that I lose my soul? And is it fair for people to be like, I don't want to look at you, Angel, because I know that Angelus is evil? Like, does that sort of make sense? The fairness versus the rightness?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something that we need to keep in mind, because, again, going back to the Vampire Diaries, if they choose to turn off the humanity, I think they are much more responsible in that situation than Angel would be.
Oh, yeah.
You know, what happened with Angel is that it was an accident. It's not something that he ever saw coming. And yet in the Vampire Diaries, they choose to turn off the humanity. I think that that makes them much more culpable in that situation.
Yeah, no, totally. That's completely. And didn't Ariana leave us a message saying that no one is ever held accountable on that. They're always
the
forgiven
characters.
For it. Like,
yeah, the characters feel very guilty, but I like themselves when it happens, when they do that to themselves. But I think the other characters and the people around that situation kind of forgive them because of the trauma that they've gone through and because that's just kind of how the vampires react. But looking at it as a black and white situation, especially compared to Buffy the Vampire Slayer, I am much less forgiving of them than I would be of Angel.
Do they do it, like, for a good cause? Like, hey, I need to go do some, like, really bad stuff in the name of good, so I'm gonna, like, turn off my humanity to do it? Or is it just like, I'm too sad about my girlfriend, I'm turning off my feelings?
I have not seen every episode of The Vampire Diaries, but I'd say most, if not all, it would be the second one. It would be,
really?
They're just being selfish, and they're just like, life is much easier to live when you have no guilt.
Yeah, no thanks. This sounds... No, I don't think so. Okay, so is there anything about Angel's situation particularly that you think should be kind of that we should take away and kind of remember in order to talk about this topic as a whole? Like, what do you think Angel's situation particularly is, you know, handles really well or perhaps handles not well, that you think is like a good or bad example of this kind of theme?
I think it's the gray area that they handle really well. And you said it when you said that Angel has the right to be happy and everyone else has the right to be upset about what happened. There is now no right or wrong answer because those two sides conflict so much. And I think that's what the show does really well, is that they pointed out, they have a whole episode or several episodes about how he should be held culpable or how he should not. And the conclusion that they come to is not a clean one, but I think it's the only one that it could really come to without one side giving to the other. And I like that it wasn't that way.
Because I feel like something does have to give in these circumstances. You have to have one side being like, okay, I get to be the whipping boy, you get to punish me for this. Or the other side being like, okay, we're going to not, you know, forgive him or whatever. You know, I feel like that in these cases, like, yes, like when it's two sides that are so opposed to each other, like that they don't make a solution together, that one side does have to give at some point. And yeah, they do kind of balance it out with Buffy. They do pay a lot of attention to it. There is obviously a ton of guilt. There's a whole, I think it sort of comes to the crux where you're like, okay, he wants to kill himself about this. So, I think that is the crux of you go like, okay, he is so good that he can't live with his badness. And then you sort of forgive him and so does everyone else.
Yeah.
So the other circumstance that we're obviously very present in pop culture at the moment is Bucky in Captain America, you know, Winter Soldier and Civil War. Captain America Civil War came out possibly since the last time we podcasted. When did we last record a podcast? Like, a while.
I don't remember.
over a month ago. So, yeah, I think Captain America Civil War came out since then, and Karen saw it at the very early screening in April 15th preview screening, and then I saw it at the London premiere, and I've seen it 5 times at the cinema.
I've seen it 4.
Really?
Yeah.
And we both obviously have some strong feelings about Marvel in general, as you would probably know, coming into this podcast. And it's really nice, I think, middle ground in that I'd like to think that Karen, like, I am, like, very, very, very Team Cap, and Karen is Team Iron Man, though we have not discussed her thoughts on the culpability in this film, which is going to be interesting because that's what we're going to talk about now. But I think that, she's definitely not one of the Team Iron Man people who is anti-Bucky, which they very much exist, Karen. The reason that we don't talk about Iron Man is because a lot of people who are Iron Man fans, and I'm probably going to get myself in trouble for saying this in a public forum, they're really crazy in a bad way in terms of not admitting to fault. So it's a little bit of the people who are sort of defending Tony in terms of this movie are not the kind, not the kind of people that you would agree with the way that they are acting or the points they are making. So I'm interested to hear your take on it. But yeah, the Tony defense people are very much like Bucky should be held accountable for his actions and killed. So I'm presuming that's not your take on it.
No, I've also seen a lot of anti-Steve stuff, and that kills me too. Like, I don't agree
it's not your
with
fault,
that.
And I find Tony a very sympathetic character. It's just that there's apparently a bunch of people who are fans of him who are, like, they maybe project their own issues onto him, and they defend a lot of stuff about him that is not meant to be defended. There is tons of things that make this character interesting and defendable and sympathetic. The stuff that a lot of the, like, loud Iron Man fans defend is not okay. Like, it's not, like, they make excuses for things that is not good. So we won't go too much into that. We'll actually just talk about what we think instead of what everyone else thinks. So so first of all, how did you like Captain America Civil War?
I liked it a lot.
Yeah.
It was really good.
Yeah, it was really good.
I mean, I saw it 4 times. That's the most I've ever seen a movie in the theaters.
Really? It's not the most I've ever seen a movie, yeah. But I feel like it could get up there. The most I've ever seen a movie in the theater is 11 times.
Which one was that?
The first Star Trek reboot, the 2009 Star Trek. Anyway, so, yeah, I mean, we could talk for, like, a long time about all of the things about Captain America Civil War that we liked, but that's not actually why we're here, so we probably shouldn't get derailed. But obviously, the point of this movie is, you know, as a sequel from Captain America the Winter Soldier, Bucky Barnes being revealed as an assassin kept by the Soviets, kept by Hydra for the past, you know, 70 years, tortured, brainwashed, completely, yeah, completely his mind wiped and scrambled and controlled and all of this kind of stuff. And this is discovered in the end of Winter Soldier. He goes off into hiding, and then this movie picks up 2 years later, in which, you know, the other villain, Zemo, flushes Bucky out of hiding because he needs to get to Bucky in order to get his plan working. And the crux of this is basically that he wants to destroy the Avengers because they killed his family by dropping Sokovia on Sokovia. And he wants to do this by getting this information that he heard about, which is that Bucky, who Steve will defend at all costs and spends three movies proving that, was responsible for the death of Tony's parents, you know, as the Winter Soldier, and that that is something that will tear Steve and Tony apart because he expects that Tony will be very angry about it and Steve will be like, no, don't do that, which is what ends up happening. So, first of all, side note, were you aware before this movie that Bucky killed Tony's parents?
Yeah, I thought, like, that was established.
Yeah, me too, good, because apparently there were people that were like, oh my god, and I'm like, it was in the last movie, like, it was there.
Yeah.
It was right there in that video with Zola, you know, like, talking about, mm-hmm. like, it was right there, guys. It wasn't said in words, but it was so heavily
implied. Yeah, exactly.
It was definitely implied that Hydra killed the parents, and that's what Steve knew, because the big thing as well is that Steve knew it was Hydra that killed them. It wasn't a random accident. Tony's always believed it to be a random accident because he's, like, naive as fuck. Yeah, Steve knew this because of this video, but the video is cut in a way that, like, they show the Stark article and then they show a flash of the arm, like Bucky walking across the screen. Like, it's... You know, Steve may say he didn't know it was Bucky, but the audience, like, there's two and two, and if you can't do that math, I don't think you should be coming to, you know, movies rated past, you know, past a 12 rating or something like that. Okay, so yeah, basically, point is, we've got two circumstances here. We've got Bucky in general and his actions in general as the Winter Soldier, and whether he is culpable for them. And this is definitely, like, a plot that happens in the comics. Like, he goes on trial for it. And it's something that fandom has been thinking about and talking about for the last 2 years, because this is an incredibly... a story that's resonated very deeply with a lot of people. Like, a lot of people who were not deep Marvel fans became deep Bucky fans because of how horrific and sympathetic this story is. And then there's also the circumstance of... when Tony, like, the specific fight of when Tony discovers that this was Bucky, and Steve's there and Bucky's there and Tony's there, that he flat out tries to kill Bucky. Like, despite the fact that, and this is the crunching point for me, despite the fact that he has already acknowledged that the Winter Soldier is not Bucky and that he's not, that he's actually, you know, in his own way, like, he's already processed that and he's already logically been like, okay, I get the circumstance, we're okay. So, I don't want to, like, argue about it. I'm curiously asking, like, when you watched this the first time, or the second or third or fourth, kind of, how did you react to Tony's reaction, I guess, to that circumstance?
Okay, let me preface this by saying that I have thought about this scene in particular more than any other part of the movie, because I have such problems with it. Because the first time I saw this, my initial reaction was that I got really mad at Tony Because, like you said, he knows that the Winter Soldier is not Bucky and that he was brainwashed into doing those things. And he tells Cap, I don't care. He doesn't care about the situation. He just wants to kill him. And it makes me very, very angry. And I think I got angry because I knew that people who don't like Tony would dislike him even more after this. You know, I was kind of mad
mad at him for, like, digging his own hole.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, dude, you are already, like, 26 feet under. Like, you just need to stop at some point. And I don't necessarily blame, like, the Russos or anything for, like, this particular situation because I do think it had to happen, but I think it's really unfortunate that it had to happen at this point in the movie after he had already accepted.
It's not what I was expecting. I was expecting Tony to be like, don't trust that guy, hate him, never going to trust him, like, without having that, like, okay, we've got to the point where, like, we've had that conflict, it's resolved. I know that it's like, but I don't care. Those hands killed my mother, so I am going to end that body. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like,
and that's, yeah. And then
it to be like that.
After watching it a few more times and thinking about this over and over and over again, that's what I keep coming back to. And I don't want to excuse his actions. I don't want to be, you know, like some of those Tony fans who just write everything off and blame, you know, his actions on other people. But he is right. Like, he says, I don't care. He killed my mom. And I think in that moment, Tony just snaps. And I don't like that he did that, but I think at least it's important to acknowledge that is the reason why he did that.
I think the argument's kind of been made that, like, he, you know, not particularly by me, but just, like, by people, that, like, it's kind of not that in character for him to even care that much about his parents, but I don't know. There's a lot of, like, that it's something that, you know, he's never heard of before, that, you know, that we've never heard from him before, that he's always been really, like, kind of disparaging and distant about his parents, that he, you know, possibly loved Jarvis more than either of his parents, but I don't know. I don't necessarily think that that's the case. I think the movie did a pretty good job of establishing, like, with that flashback scene, and he's clearly always had daddy issues. Like, he's, no matter what he says, he's always been really weird about his parents. At the very least, he's got issues, and this is probably making those issues a lot worse. But yeah, it's for me, the initial reaction is sort of reasonable. The initial reaction of like just freaking out and, like, you know, flying off the handle, like, whether that's in a murderous capacity or a kind of, like, you know, this is the equivalent of the conversation that Giles has with Buffy, except Giles doesn't then try and go and kill Angel, if you know what I mean. Like, this is him saying, like, being like, I know that, like, you know, like, no matter what, can we just point out that he did that and that I have to deal with it? This is Tony's moment of doing that, except he goes and tries to kill him. And for me, it's kind of that he doesn't stop. It's not that he starts, it's this, that he doesn't rein himself back. Like, he only stops when Steve nearly kills him, and Steve very nearly kills him. It's not just like, it's not just like accidentally, like, oh, we fought until you're too damaged. Steve stopped himself killing him on, like, which was, you know, it's kind of like in Age of Ultron, Tony's like, you know, don't trust a guy without a dark side, and Steve says, maybe you just haven't seen it yet, and yeah, there it is. So they're both a bit extreme. Like, you know, Steve does at least, you know, stop himself. I don't know where Tony would have stopped in that circumstance. But yeah, I would have liked to think that anyone, you know, knowing anything about Bucky, and we have no idea how much Tony knows in terms of, like, has he read all of those Hydra files about, you know, what was done to him or anything like that. Like, does he have any logical understanding except for the kind of stuff between him and Steve within this movie? I would have liked to think that someone in that circumstance, it would have been impossible not to react badly. It would have been impossible to be like, oh yeah, that's cool, like, immediately. Like, that's a joke. Like, that's not a thing. But I really would have liked to think that, like, after, like, getting in a few punches, he would have been like, oh, if you know what I mean. Like, I can't understand why he would take it that far. And that's what really bothered me about his actions. Like, the kind of... The thing with Tony is when... And I saw someone say this about the film, and this is so derailed from Bucky, and, like, that's probably a good thing, because if it was just a podcast about Bucky, it would go for 4 hours. But I will get back to that. But the thing about Tony that I saw someone compare this, so, you know, like, the speech in that movie of Peggy. I really hope everyone's seen Civil War, by the way, otherwise this is going to make, like, no sense. But the speech, you know, the funeral of Peggy's words, and, you know, plant yourself like a tree. The thing about Steve, and it's the reason that Charla chooses Steve as well. It's the reason that Charla is like, actually, you're the one that I want to support, is that Steve has his viewpoint and he sticks by it. And that's it. You know, it doesn't matter who comes against him. He's like, that's what I feel. That's what I believe is right. This is how I'm going to handle it. My feelings not influenced by anything except my own self, or, you know, maybe whatever they are influenced by, whether they're influenced by, you know, Peggy or Bucky or whatever it is, like, he makes up his mind for whatever reasons he has and he sticks by it. Whereas Tony, every time Tony gets a new idea, he sticks by it like it's the only idea he's ever had in the world. And he doesn't seem to remember that he's done this 14 other times, if you know what I mean. Like, he doesn't seem to remember that, oh, yesterday I believed that with my entire heart, but today I believe this with my entire heart. And he just goes in on every new stance he ever comes across without any comprehension of, like, it being a contradiction. Like, he doesn't really seem to learn, if you know what I mean. Like, someone compared it to, like, he, you know, unlike Steve, like, planting himself like a tree, Tony uproots himself, replants, but pretends he's been planted there the whole time. And that's sort of what it's true, and it's sort of what I find stressful.
It is true.
It's interesting about the character. It doesn't mean I hate him, but he doesn't learn, and just this factor of, like, believing something so deeply. I'm, like, literally punching the air to emphasize my words right now. Like, believing something so deeply, you know, that yesterday you thought the opposite of, and then tomorrow you might believe something else that deeply. I don't feel like that's a great way to handle things, like, without perspective of, like, why your mind changed, I guess. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, last thing about Tony, because I really do want to talk about Bucky more, but I think the thing with Tony is he doesn't learn his lesson, and that's something that I found very frustrating about the character, and something that if they do Iron Man 4, I really hope he does. I think that he's a fantastic character who's very interesting and much more morally gray than Captain America, which is fine. It's fine to have characters like that, but I think he needs to continually grow, and every time he takes two steps forward, he takes one back, and it gets really frustrating after a while. But I think what you said about him, you know, continually uprooting himself is, it shows the kind of person he is. It shows that he's not always on the same path. He jumps around a lot. He gets distracted a lot. His mind works in a different way. And I think that's why he reacts to Bucky in that way. But that being said, bringing it back to Bucky, I think we're both in agreement that he was brainwashed. We literally saw that in action in this movie with the code words. And how can you hold somebody responsible for that?
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, if he got angry and then stopped, I would have been like, yeah, okay, that's fine. Like, and, you know, like, but it's the fact that he did not stop and he was not going to stop. And I don't know, like, but yeah, Bucky is in Marvel. And this is, like, what I don't really understand, how anyone doesn't have this viewpoint, but apparently they are. He is so painted as a victim, like, and that's the thing, and it's not questionable, like, and ever since the Winter Soldier movie came out, like, Sebastian Stan's been, like, making angry faces in interviews with people who are like, so you were the villain, and he's like, no, I wasn't. Like, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, and he's 100% painted as the victim in of his circumstances. And yet the movies have not yet allowed him the chance to, I guess, like, recover from that or be happy or anything like that. Like, and there was a little bit of controversy recently with something some of the writers said, which then got clarified. Now, I kind of knew that it wasn't as bad as it sounded because I really love these writers and I know that they have good opinions, but people freaked out, and I'll show you in a second. These movies want you to be sympathetic to Bucky. Like, there's a reason that, like, no one has stopped talking about this for the past 2 years since Winter Soldier came out. Like, the scenes, no matter how, like, frickin' badass he is as, like, a villain, like, I don't want, no, not a villain, a weapon, like, you know, how badass he is as the Winter Soldier, it's like blaming the gun. That's what it is. Like, Tony is trying to break the gun that shot his mother into pieces instead of going after the guy who fired the gun. And it's just like, that's freaking stupid. It's the same as, like, you know, smashing a plate on the floor. It's an erratic, yes, very human thing, but it's stupid. Like, it's completely not in any way rational, because that's what Bucky was. Like, he was not, you know, not culpable, but, obviously, he's on a, you know, even bigger scale than Angel. Like, he's done, I mean, I suppose Angel lived quite a long time. I don't, maybe their head count is similar by now, but Bucky did these, you know, hugely sickening things. Like, in the comics, he, like, burnt an orphanage down, like, to the ground with, like, kids inside it. Like, there's, like, twisted, like, they used him for the stuff they didn't want to put on real people's conscience, you know? Like, they really got their money's worth with him. And the movies definitely paint him in such a sympathetic light. There's, like, a reason, you know, as I said, that everyone's been in utter mess about this. I mean, I don't know. Do you know anyone that came out of, like, the Winter Soldier movie, like, thinking that he was, like, a cool villain instead of, like, the saddest child in the world?
No, I don't. I know nobody who felt that way.
Yeah. Apparently, they're there, but, you know, who knows?
Goodness.
But, yeah, it's one of the most sort of empathetic and, I think, like, visceral portrayals of this particular circumstance in any media, certainly any media at the moment. You know, they show the brainwashing. They show the how compliant and helpless he is. And then in Winter Soldier and then in Civil War, there's obviously the increase of learning about, you know, the trigger words that would make him compliant to whoever said them and all of that kind of stuff. So there really is, I think using the trigger words was kind of a good way to do it, because it gave them a real, in the comics he has a kill code. He has a code that will make him revert back to being in control of, either make him shut down or make him be in control of the, you know, they'll be in control of the Winter Soldier. And it was Sputnik, which was the working title for Civil War. So we kind of knew the pieces were going to be there. And yeah, so Sputnik was his original kill code. And then that was the working title. So we kind of knew there was going to be some sort of code brainwashing. It was going to be about that. But I think having that there is like a really solid thing for the audience to grasp of, like, okay, that's how you kind of like turn him on / off, and if they can get rid of that, then he'll be okay. Because in the comics with the Winter Soldier, honestly, what happens is he touches a cosmic cube and all his memories come back, and it's very Deus Ex Machina. It's not like a legit and humanized story, and I think the way they've done it in the movies is much better. But a couple of things that I wanted to point out as well is that when you saw Civil War, did you expect Bucky to be as healed and lucid as he was? Or did you think he would be, like, confused and not really know who he was at this point? Like, were you actually surprised at, like, what he was like in this movie?
No, I don't think so, only because I knew that it had been some time between movies, and so I think I was more just hopeful that this was the Bucky that we would end up getting, just because I'd been wanting it since Winter Soldier. I'd wanted it in Winter Soldier, and obviously the narrative didn't allow for that. There wasn't really enough room to show that side of him by the end, so the fact that we got it in Civil War just made me so, so happy.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about that that's super depressing, because there's obviously been a lot of people thinking and talking about, like, how Bucky would recover and what it would take for him to recover. And a lot of people thought it would be worse than this. Like, a lot of people thought that he would be, like, mega traumatized. He might be. Like, he's been living a very quiet life and he hasn't wanted to be, you know, around Steve. He hasn't wanted to be anywhere that he might be a danger, or anywhere that, you know, he might be forced to face his past. But he's okay. Like, he's, you know, non-violent. He hasn't been out, like, randomly taking revenge on people, which is something a lot of people thought that he might be. He was much more sort of just wanting to be quiet and wanting to be at peace, which was very similar to Angel, like very similar to him just wanting to stay in that, you know, mansion and do Tai Chi. You know, Bucky just wants to stay in his flat and do Tai Chi and eat plums. Like,
eat plums.
Yeah, so that makes it even sadder, because he's not like this, like, frail, confused, like, easily, like, spooked, wild animal. He is very much himself, and he has a lot of his memories, or he's gathering a lot of his memories, and he definitely has his sense of self. And that means that they really had to fry his brain every time. It wasn't like they wiped him once, and it means that he would have started recovering every single time that they had to wipe him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It wasn't just like he was like a robot for 70 years. It was that any time that they left him too long, he would start recovering. Because what I mean is the healing. Like, a lot of people thought that for him to even be Bucky again, he would have to undergo some special, like, thing. Like, in the comics, as I said, it's the Cosmic Cube. He touches it and he gets all his memories back. Or that we thought that he'd have to undergo some, like, you know, he'd have to, something would have to happen to him in order for him to, his brain to heal and get the memories back. But this just happened naturally, when his brain was left alone and not fried by Hydra. So the fact that was all it took for him to recover is super depressing, because it means they would have really had to keep frying him every single time, like, really badly. Anyway, as I said, we could talk about this for a long time, but I actually wanted to talk about something specific with the culpability situation. So the movie ends Civil War with Bucky basically choosing to go back into cryo because he doesn't trust the fact that those triggers are in his mind and that he could be used like that again. Like, and he, you know, so he thinks that is the best option for him. I think that it is somewhat hopeful that at no point in this 2 years has he ever pulled an Angel and just shot himself through the mouth. You know, like, he has some grasp that he doesn't want to die and that he wants to live. You know, even though that, like, in that conversation with Tony while they're fighting, you know, he asks, you know, do you remember them? And Bucky says, like, I remember all of them. Like, he remembers everything he's done as the Winter Soldier. It's not like he's just woken up and been like, what? Who was I? Like, he remembers. He was like a backseat driver. It was still him, if you know what I mean. But afterwards, the writers were asked about it in a podcast, and someone said, why was it necessary to put the Winter Soldier back on ice? And one of the guys said, well, I mean, because he is, for one thing, give or take his intellectual capacity, he is 100% guilty. And to just have him and Steve just running around getting fruit salads with him on some island, it's a little too unpunished in a way. This is not a guy who should be running around happily. He may not be 100% guilty, but he's damn sure not 100% innocent. So that was a sort of a statement made by the writers, which is not how I would have put it, because it sounds like that they are saying that that's how they feel about him, but it's not what they meant. They clarified on another podcast, they clarified that it's kind of what the narrative means. Apparently, like, if given that that scene with Tony, given that what we've learned Bucky did, that there was not, the narrative did not allow Bucky to be happy or have peace in this movie. Do you think that that's fair and right? Like, do you think that that is, you know, it's very hard not to be indulgent and just say, yes, he needs all the fruit salads, because I think that that's kind of what everyone would like to say. But do you think that this would have been like a really like harsh, like a cheap shot at Tony, or like a just something not appropriate if the movie had actually ended with Bucky and Steve kind of happy on the run, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, that is difficult. This sort of falls in line with what I find myself most interested in, which I mentioned before, is like the law and how the law views these situations.
Yeah.
And I think that, of course, I want Bucky to be happy, and of course I want him and Cap to have all the fruit salads in the world, but the point is that society is always going to see him as the villain.
And you know what's horrible?
Until proven otherwise.
They know it's what? Him as well. I found that was something I found really shocking about the movie, is that they, on the news, they said it was him. They said it was his name, like James Buchanan Barnes. Like, so not the world knows that that guy is the dead Bucky from the 40s, and that he has become, like, quote unquote,
right,
the enemy. Like, that's really screwed up. Like, yeah.
Yeah. And you can't blame people for wanting to keep him in a cage. You know, that's what I wanted to say. But at the same time, like, I think the masses are always going to be in hysterics over stuff like this. And it is very difficult, just like it is with the law, to kind of put the same sentence on every case, because what Bucky did was absolutely horrible, or I should say what the Winter Soldier did was absolutely horrible, but he was still brainwashed. And I think just like Angel has to hold himself responsible and be careful about what happens to him so that never happens again, so does Bucky. I mean, those words still exist, and that's why he decides of his own volition to go on ice again, because he wants to be careful and he wants to make sure it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And I think that's absolutely fair. And it's just, you know, people, yes, I want him to be happy and yes, I want him to be free, but people are going to fear him until he can show them that he is not that person. And I think that's why he can't go running around.
There's been a ton of, like, arguments about this, like, you know, and fandom, you know, it's definitely something heavily addressed by, you know, him, about whether the world forgives him, whether the various Avengers would, how they would react to him, whether he would go on trial, because as I said, he does in the comics. FYI, in the comics, he, like, basically this argument is he, like, a war criminal, or is he the world's longest-serving prisoner of war, if you know what I mean? That's the kind of thing. Like, is he, like, you know, someone who should get, like, a full pardon and a frickin' government pension, or is he someone who should be, like, executed? And in the comics, America, the American courts find him innocent, but the Russian courts, because apparently it's done by, like, an international court, don't. And he's extradited to a gulag in which he fights a bear, and it gets real weird. And Natasha and Sharon are sent to rescue him from the gulag. Anyway, that would make an interesting movie. I'm really glad we didn't have him fighting a bear. Anyway, so the guys sort of clarified it more in this other podcast, where, you know, someone was like, you said this the other day, people were curious why Bucky had to be punished. And Stephen McFeely, who's slightly more sensitive, one of the two of them, it was not him that made the original comment, said, we don't mean to say that Bucky deserves to be punished, but I'll just say this. At the end of the movie, think about where we are. Tony Stark has just learned that his parents have been murdered. The guy who did it is standing right there, and one of his dear friends didn't tell him. It's a dark ending, a melancholy ending, and it's a bit ambiguous. There's no version of the next scene of Bucky being happy. There's no tag where Bucky gets to live a happy life, when that is how the movie just ended. So that would be a little bit tone deaf. And then he says, that being said, Bucky is absolutely a victim, and Bucky, if he went to the court of law, would be innocent of all charges. And then the other guy's like, at very least, he might be guilty of manslaughter. And then McFeely interrupts and says, I think I did a little homework on this. It would be debatable about whether he would be charged with anything at all. The point is, we the audience forgive Bucky because we know exactly what happened. I'm not positive it's that easy for Bucky to forgive himself. And sort of he points out the bit that was the most troubling for me in the whole movie, which is where, you know, he says to Steve, I don't know if I'm worth all this. And Steve, you know, tries to say, you know, what you did wasn't you, basically. And he kind of just looks back up and he said, yeah, but I did it. And the way he sort of delivers that line is my favorite, well, not my favorite bit in the movie in like a good way, but my favorite bit in the movie in a depressing way, the delivery of that line. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like that a character like that, yeah, is going to always have this kind of self-hatred. And he's been doing his best until now to kind of stay away from being involved in anything that would ever get him back into that. Like, you know, he's so resigned the whole time. Like, he doesn't want to do violence. He doesn't want to be in a fight. He just wants to be left alone, but no. And so, yeah, it's very, very difficult, and I don't know whether the, you know, it feels like the entire MCU could literally just focus around, like, every movie, just being around, like, what's going on with Bucky? It feels like too big a story not to focus on, if you know what I mean. Like, in terms of, okay, so he's in Wakanda. Is Black Panther movie going to be all about, like, the governments of Wakanda attacking, you know, and something like that? Or, you know, is Avengers Infinity War going to be about, like, the world, you know, having to react to him? Like, is this going to be, like, something that gets, like, quickly swept by the narrative or not? Like, I don't feel like it is. I don't feel like these screenwriters and directors are just going to kind of sweep this under the table and be like, yeah, quickly, okay, yes, all right, we've all decided that Bucky is innocent now, and so that he can be, like, in the Avengers. Like, I feel like there's going to have to be serious plot about him in nearly every Marvel movie coming up, which I'm okay with, but yeah, like, given the scope of film compared to television, like, the amount of time you can spend on character work, even in an action show like Buffy, compared to a movie where you have much less time for character work, how do you think that the narrative will go about treating Bucky in the future, I guess? Like, it's obviously been very sympathetic to him so far. Like, do you think it was enough? Like, do you think they're going to be able to actually solve this in a way, given what they've done in the past? Will they be able to solve it in a way that is doing justice to this character? Because I think it has to be said that, like, this particular arc, I know I'm, like, terribly biased, but this particular arc is so much, like, deeper, or it needs to be addressed in a, you know, plotty, non-action movie way than pretty much anything else the MCU's ever done.
I absolutely agree with that, because we spent the Winter Soldier establishing who he was and what he's done, what he's capable of. It was only at the very end of the movie that you really see a change. Like, you see him struggling earlier on, but of course, you know, they zapped him and he reverted back to being the Winter Soldier. But by the end, he made his own decision in saving Steve. And then we get Civil War, where finally we get to see who Bucky is now. And of course, he goes into Winter Soldier mode, and that's an issue all on its own. But by the end, you see him getting help from other people. It's such a long story, and it spanned two whole movies where he was essentially the focus. And I think they need to resolve that. They can't just let it hang. And I don't think that they're going to sweep it under the rug and be like, okay, he's better now. I think they are going to show us how he evolves from this point forward. And honestly, like, I really want that. I keep thinking, like, man, you know, I just want a whole nother movie focused on him and, like, give him his own spinoff movie. Like, I would be totally cool
Netflix
with that.
Series, can I just say? Netflix yes. series. Like, because that is the kind of character development that this is, a story that needs more than just the constraints of a film where you have to balance other characters. Like, it's such a pithy and delicate story that I really don't understand how they're going to be able to not focus on it.
And especially which movies they're going to focus on it next, because I don't think that he's going to be that big in Black Panther if he's in there at all, just because I at least don't want it to take away from T'Challa's. Yeah.
Yeah, I really agree with that. Like, I don't want necessarily, like, the Black Panther movie to be, you know, especially don't want to hear, like, the complaints of, like, 57,000 critics being like, this movie that was meant to be, like, about the first black, leading superhero in the Marvel is actually all, like, to, further the story of this white boy, which is what would happen if it was about Bucky. And you know, we've already got this great, you know, kind of origin story of T'Challa, you know, and how he kind of changes his feelings about how he wants to react to stuff and all of that. And so he could have this whole, so much plot, like, you know, learning about what the Black Panther actually is, like, and all of that. But given where we left him in this movie, it's very difficult to wonder, like, anything except what's going on with him and Bucky and Steve. Like, is Steve hanging out and, like, is he hiding from the government in Wakanda? Like, what's going on? And they've left it at this point where it's, like, Wakanda, Bucky, Steve, T'Challa. And so it's, like, is that going to be, like, totally, like, Bucky's just, like, it's going to be, like, Star Wars where, like, Han Solo's just, like, up on the wall, you know, like, frozen in the carbonite or whatever? Like, is Bucky just going to be, like, a room decoration, like, during the background during Black Panther, which could be funny. Like, you know, it's just like, oh, you know, every so often T'Challa goes in there and, like, reads him a bedtime story, you know, like, or whatever. Something like that, as opposed to him, like, being unfrozen or, like, being about that plot, which would be fine. But that would mean there would be, like, another, you know, 2 or 3 years before if he actually stays frozen. And I can't imagine him just being like, oh, yeah, we're frozen. Like, Wakanda's the most, like, technologically advanced country in the world, and they've still got, like, people like Wanda on their side who can do, like, mind stuff. There's a ton of options for how Bucky might be healed, and, you know, whether that process is something we see. He certainly, you know, obviously the plot in the comics is that he, you know, ends up, you know, trying to redeem himself for his actions, like, as Captain America, which literally only happens because he refuses to let anyone else, like, touch Steve's stuff, basically. Like, he's like, Tony basically says to him, like, if you don't do it, you know the government is going to make someone do it. And he's like, screw you all, no. You know, I don't want to do it, but no one else can do it. And so he does it. And as Captain America, when Steve dies, which thank God didn't happen in this Civil War, but may happen in Infinity War. I'm still not counting it out for Infinity War, honestly. Or at least the beginning of it, and then it'll be back by the end of it. Anyway, point is, the narrative, Bucky, he's 100% sold as a victim. Like, if you didn't get that by now, then you don't have the emotional range to process these movies correctly. However, you know, will he ever get the chance to be happy? I don't know. No one in these movies is ever happy. There's never been a bit in any Marvel movie when anyone is happy. Like, I don't think. Like, maybe like 5 minutes at a time, but
and then something else makes it all go to hell. Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I think that they are absolutely setting Bucky up to be a hero, though, and it's just a matter of time for when that happens.
Yeah,
I don't want to wait until Infinity War to see that happen, just because I want a lot more Bucky and I want a lot more right now. But if that were to happen, if they were to figure out how to get all the Hydra junk out of his head, it would be so great to see him fighting alongside the team as an Avenger and having the world see him save them. I think that would be so fantastic. And I'm just it's got to happen. I mean, he's Captain America's best friend, and they're obviously, like you said, 100% painting him as a victim. So at some point, I think he has to pick up some tool and just say, okay, you know, I'm a good guy now. I'm an Avenger. Let's go save the world.
They're not going to be, and they're not, like, they haven't spent, like, three movies making everyone, like, desperately love him. Like, without the chance to actually, like, headline the franchise, if you know what I mean. Like, they know, like Karen, like, when I was at that London premiere, like, you would not have believed. Like, he was, like, number one after Robert Downey Jr. Like, number one in terms of, like, the way people reacted when he came out. Or, like, even more so than that when, like, all day they were playing, like, you know, clips on the big screen of, like, bits from the movie, the trailer, or bits from the other movies. Every time it was him, people went freaking nuts. And, like, then the, you know, the hype man before the premiere started was, like, walking around talking to fans being, like, who's your favorite character? And everyone just kept saying Bucky. And then he was, like, he was clearly expecting, like, more of, like, a, like, and he was clearly weirded out. Like, he did not know that people were so deep in this one direction, but I feel like it's everyone who, like, makes a dedicated effort to the Captain America fandom, like, i.e. all of the people that would go queue up to be at the premiere, would there, like, have got some feelings about Bucky. And I think that, and then when Robert arrived, that was, like, a very big cheer, because, like, everyone, like, on the, passing by on the street, you know, like, knows who he is as a celebrity, but besides him, Sebastian was, like, the reaction to him was bigger than Chris, like, by a lot.
Wow.
Yeah.
That makes me so happy.
Yeah, it was so weird, but yeah. And I don't know, it's so they know. Anyway, this is so, like, I really hope that everyone listening to this is, like, a fan of Buffy and Captain America, because we haven't talked about Teen Wolf at all yet.
I know, we should probably get to that soon.
Okay, well, good segue, because the big thing, like, after Winter Soldier came out was just after 3B of Teen Wolf as well, just after we'd had the Styles and the Nagitsune plotline. And so there was lots and lots and lots of, like, comparison of Scott and Styles to Steve and Bucky. So, Teen Wolf has definitely had its share of this kind of mind control and, you know, whatever you want to call it, like, in that case it was possession. And all of that kind of stuff. There's been several big examples of it with major characters, as well as, like, many smaller examples of it with minor characters or one-off situations. Styles the Nagitsune was obviously a really big one, but the first major character that happened in was actually the season before that, in season two with Jackson. And when he became the Kanemar after he got the bite, you know, Jackson as the Kanemar kills a whole bunch of people. The way that this is treated by the various characters, you know, while they're discovering what's going on with the character, you know, what's going on with the Kanemar, you know, at first they think it's Lydia and then they discover it's Jackson and all of that kind of stuff. But Derek, who at this point is still, like, super grumpy and not really, just very, like, you know, what's the word for, what's that word for people that hate everyone? Misanthropic. Derek's very misanthropic. He wants to kill the Kanemar, like, despite the others arguing that, like, its human form has no idea. So, like, he's out to kill Lydia, and then they're like, it's not Lydia. And the pack tries to protect both when they think it's Lydia and then later Jackson from that. So Derek is in the camp of, like, it's killing people, it's an evil monster, has to be killed. Though its human person is, you know, possibly totally unaware.
Yeah, and I think that is so interesting, even though I don't agree with that perspective. It's very much a Xander perspective on Angel, because he feels like, okay, this person is doing terrible things. The best way to stop them from doing terrible things in the future is to kill them. It's not great, but it's also, I think, a valid point of view for them, given what they've gone through and what they're aware of. I mean, Derek is, you know, we learned very worldly. He knows a lot about the supernatural world, and I think he's aware of how dangerous the Kanema can be. If you can't stop the person from turning into the Kanema, what other choice do you have but to kill the Kanema and kill that person as a result? It's not great. Obviously, we don't want it to happen as viewers of the show because we like Jackson and we don't want to hold him accountable for what somebody else is making him do. But from their perspective, it's basically the easiest solution. Not the best solution, but the easiest one.
Yeah, and it doesn't even seem like a particularly, like, it's not like a moral judgment. It's on, you know, on Derek's part either. It's not like, oh, we, taking him to court and holding him accountable. It's more like, you know, they kind of treat him more like an animal. Like, oh, there's a bear who's been attacking people. Let's shoot the bear, you know, kind of situation.
Or the gorilla.
Or the gorilla. As far as my memory serves. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Jackson ends up sort of discovering what's happening to him, and he tries to warn others about it, like when he realizes how dangerous he is. That's a nice sign, I suppose, that he's, you know, he's trying to do the best he can. And then there's that weird moment where he kind of attacks himself and he kind of claws himself to death and then goes into that weird jelly cocoon, which may or may not have been an action controlled by Gerard, because Gerard claims it wasn't him, but then, I don't know, that was a weird moment. But with his actions, he definitely kind of freaks out when he discovers that it's him, and then I think the worry is that he, like, becomes too far gone, you know, and that he's not able to be Jackson anymore, that he's, you know, just the Kanema. And there's the whole moment with Lydia and the key and her bringing him back into himself by, you know, reminding him of a human memory, which is incredibly similar to Steve and Bucky in The Winter Soldier, to be honest. And then after that, he becomes a normal werewolf. Well, they kind of reset him by quote-unquote killing him. A lot of people allegedly die in Teen Wolf that I'm like, did they really die? How did they heal from dying? If you heal from dying, you didn't die. You were just almost dead. Anyway, point is, he apparently, you know, recovers from being the Kanema, and this is sort of where it comes into it about culpability, is because he becomes a normal werewolf because, yeah, obviously became the Kanema because he had the supernatural activation bite, but became the Kanema instead of the werewolf. It becomes a normal werewolf who bears the mark of taking innocent lives by having blue eyes. And it was like one of the first times we saw the blue eyes, and back when we were like, what the hell does this mean? And even though he has no memory of it or anything like that. So the narrative of Teen Wolf, at least in terms of their, like, supernatural canon, holds him responsible, like, as a murderer, and he has to go around the werewolf world, like, meeting other werewolves, looking like that, with this mark of, like, hey, I killed people. Like, we don't know how common that is. We don't see that many blue-eyed, werewolves. So, I mean, I know that we, you know, don't give Jackson a ton of thought because he left the show, but the canon could sort of also argue that he, like, left Beacon Hills because he couldn't deal with, like, being around what he'd done as the Kanema in order to have a fresh start and, like, not be around the people who he'd hurt or anything like that. Like, if you wanted to sort of apply some canon meaning to what the character leaving the show meant. But, yeah, have you ever kind of thought about what it means for him to be, like, marked as a murderer, as a werewolf, like, given what he did as the Kanema?
No, I hadn't thought about that before, and I think that's really interesting, and honestly, I'm drawing parallels with Derek even, given his time with Paige and why he gained the blue eyes, and it's interesting because you don't necessarily have to have done something wrong. I mean, of course it was terrible what happened to both of them and what they both did, but for different reasons, they kind of both, Derek did it for, you know, did the wrong thing for the right reason, and Jackson was not in control when he did those things. So I do think it's really interesting that the narrative holds them responsible and that, you know, they have to live with having blue eyes. It's something that I think will remind them of what's happened and maybe make them, you know, force them to make better choices. Who knows? But it's, yeah, Jackson being culpable for what he did doesn't quite feel right just because he was controlled by two other people who were not good people and made him do terrible, terrible things. He was, like you said about Bucky, just the weapon. You know, he was not at all in control over his actions.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe the blue eyes is kind of like in Harry Potter, like getting to, I may have made this comparison right back when we did the show, like the show originally. But maybe it's like getting to see Thestrals, because when Harry first starts to see Thestrals in the fifth book, he doesn't know why, he doesn't know what it is that means it means when you can see them, if you know what I mean. But it turns out that it's like the people who can see Thestrals are the people who have seen a death occur. And Harry does not remember seeing his parents' death, but he can still see Thestrals because his physical eyes saw a death occur, even though he has no memory of it, if you know what I mean. So maybe the blue eyes are kind of like that, in that it's just literally that's what happened. It doesn't really matter culpability-wise or not.
Didn't Harry not see the Thestrals until after Cedric's death?
True. No, true. You are right. Sorry. So it's the exact opposite of that. That is true. I think that argument was made. I totally forgot. Yeah, that argument was made about it. It's like, why didn't he see it when he was a baby? And it's because he had to have actually known he saw it and acknowledged it. So it's the opposite of that. Sorry. God, I'm an idiot. And yeah, in that case, yes, why does Teen Wolf hold them accountable when it's not, you know, if it is just a natural process, why does it count if it wasn't, you know, like, do they just turn blue out of guilt, or is it like a physical, natural, automatic reaction, you know?
And like we had been wondering that too, the whole guilt thing, given like Theo and everything that happened with him, but like there are so many factors and so many things that we don't fully comprehend about how the Teen Wolf world works yet, that it's very difficult to decide, okay, this is why Jackson has blue eyes and this is why Derek has blue eyes and this is why Theo doesn't. I mean, considering that Theo's a chimera and like all this other stuff, it's, yeah, there's just, I think there's too much to account for to really truly understand it.
Yeah. Point is, it kind of sucks for Jackson to have to go around life like explaining to people that, hey, actually, I'm not really a murderer. Not really. You know? Like,
yeah.
Especially when it means that the hunters are not meant to hunt, like, you know, innocent werewolves. Like, at least the Argents were not meant to, even though Gerard was, like, the worst. You know, the whole reason, in retrospect, the reason that they were so horrified at him, like, stringing up that Omega and cutting him in half was because that was, like, an orange-eyed werewolf. The werewolf hunters had proof that they knew that that werewolf was, like, innocent and hadn't bitten anyone and hadn't killed anyone, you know?
Yeah.
So Jackson doesn't have that protection. Anyway. The biggest thing that this has happened within Teen Wolf is what the one I mentioned, Styles, with the Nagitsune. And so that's like an overarching theme of the entire season. And for him, that's a possession. It's not himself being controlled. It's him being possessed by another being and used, basically. And it has like these really, you know, horrible ongoing effects, you know, including him like losing time, not knowing where he was, like writing things, you know, to, you know, that he doesn't remember, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then it gets to the point where he's made to think he's having the same, like, degenerative disease as his mother had, which was a fun few days for everyone involved.
Sometimes I think back on that episode and that episode of the podcast we recorded, and I just
like, I don't want to do this. Like, yeah.
I think we spent the first like 10 or 20 minutes just being like, do we really have to record this? It was awful.
Yeah. So he eventually discovers it's the Negitsune and he locks himself in Aiken House. Like, so he knows that he's not got the disease, but he sort of knows that he's volatile and ends up in the crazy Aiken House. I just want to talk a bit about some of the things the Negitsune does, like, while in Styles, and how much damage is actually caused, like, there, and what he's culpable from, I guess. So how much of this do you sort of remember clearly? Because he possesses people. Like, he kind of makes, you know, them attack each other and stuff like that. That's sort of the first big thing that starts happening when he's still Styles, you know, when he's still in Styles.
I just remember Bad Moon Rising hospital scene.
Yeah.
Because there was so much carnage.
Yeah, and that's the thing about that as well, because that's after they make the, they take the Styles out of the Styles, like when there's two of them, you know? When, yeah, he, Bad Moon Rising, which is in the finale of that, he ends up basically controlling the Oni, like he takes over the control of the Oni, and the Oni, you know, along with the Negitsune, like, basically, like, kill an entire hospital worth of people. And my question here is about whether anyone ever was like, hey, Sheriff, did your kid just, like, kill a hospital full of people? We don't really know what happened there. It's very unclear by the show, like, you know, Melissa is injured in that bit of carnage and then later is, like, healed in an unnatural way. So because of their final showdown being, like, an illusion, you know, in that Japanese garden, I'm unsure about, like, what happened in the hospital, like, if they undid it all, like, when they did that, or if it was, like, also an illusion. It's quite unclear. But the point is that Negitsune was the one that came out of Styles. You know when that weird thing happened?
Mm-hmm.
That I still don't really understand.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the thing. That is a difference between Buffy and Teen Wolf, and of course there are many, but on Buffy, they explain away why people don't remember certain things. They say, you know, oh, the mind just always, like, tries to reason with itself. People don't want to believe that vampires exist, so they make up, you know, oh, they were just kids on drugs and stuff like that.
It's the horse with the arrow in the forehead theory. Do you know?
I do not.
Okay,
no.
It's like, it's in the play Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead. And it's basically this talking about this theory that more than one person, I'll read you the quote, okay? It's quite long, yeah, but it's going to make sense to you because you're a smart lady. So one of them is telling a story, basically. One of the guys in the play is telling a story, and he says, a man breaking his journey between one place and another at a third place of no name, character, population, or significance sees a unicorn cross his path and disappear. That in itself is startling, but there are precedents for mystical encounters of various kinds. Or to be less extreme, a choice of persuasions to put it down to fancy until, my God, says a second man, I must be dreaming. I thought I saw a unicorn. At which point, a dimension is added that makes the experience as alarming as it will ever be. A third witness, you understand, adds no further dimension but only spreads it thinner, and a fourth thinner still, and the more witnesses there are, the thinner it gets and the more reasonable it becomes, until it is as thin as reality, the name we give to the common experience. Look, look, recites the crowd, a horse with an arrow in its forehead. It must have been mistaken for a deer. Like, so the more people being like, basically, the more people being like, oh, yeah, that was nothing. Like, one person being like, I saw a vampire. I totally believe what I saw. One person can convince themselves something is true. But when everyone's like, no, it wasn't that, you start doubting your own perception of reality, if you know what I mean. So that's what I think that they are doing in Buffy. They're doing a lot of horse with the arrow in its forehead, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah, and that's something that Buffy very specifically addresses. Teen Wolf does not address that, but I think we're meant to infer that people kind of, you know, write these things off. And I'm especially excited, I guess, to see how they're going to address that in season six, given that a whole hell of a lot of students saw the Beast and saw Scott change into a werewolf to fight the Beast in the library. You know, are they just going to write that off? Will it be specifically addressed? Will the town come together and acknowledge the supernatural and help Scott in, you know, his heroics? Obviously, we don't know yet, but it's something that I think some shows kind of lean in one direction over the other.
Yeah. I feel like that it is definitely a point where it has to be addressed now. Like, they've made jokes about it for long enough. Like, you know, dude at Beacon Hills and, like, stuff being covered up by the sheriff and stuff like that. But I feel like it is now at a point where, like, it's a big reveal and that people are gonna know. So, the Styles and the Nagitsune, though, like, is he held at any point, like, responsible? Like, there's no... no one really seems to hold that against him. Like, no one's like, I can't look at you, Styles, because you were the Nagitsune, you know? Like, that does not happen with him at all.
No,
why do
and...
I think that is.
I think it's because they're all very aware of the situation. They know exactly what was going on. It was an outside force. You know, unlike Angel and unlike Bucky, where these things kind of happened inside of them, you know, there's a switch that turned off or on, you know. But in this case, it was an outside evil being that found its way inside Styles and wreaked havoc. It changes things a little bit, and I think that it makes it much easier to blame that outside force rather than blame the person.
Yeah, I suppose that. With him, I've always been more curious about, like, the outside factors, not like, oh, Scott doesn't forgive you, but, like, did anyone see you, like, doing dodgy stuff that you now have to be held accountable for, which it really doesn't. So, you know, it's not even like Buffy, you know, getting expelled from school all the time. You know, I know you're a troublemaker. You're always in the places where the naughty stuff goes down, like whether it's supernatural or not. Like, these kids don't even get in trouble for their weird, like, you know, weird situations, let alone demon possession. But
I'm always very curious about how Styles feels about it himself, because clearly he does have some guilt, but I think the most guilt and worry we've seen over it didn't come in season 4 directly after 3B, but came in season 5 when Theo confronts him about, you know, Void Styles and wanting Void Styles on in his pack and the possibility of him killing, like, he killed Donovan and the repercussions for that and what it means.
Yeah.
As him as a person and possibly, like, this dark side that's in him, we don't see Styles addressing his guilt a whole lot. And, I mean, clearly I think that it's there, but it's also interesting that we don't see him thinking about it as much.
Yeah, I definitely feel like there's something of what happens between him and Theo that's definitely him being like, did it choose me because it knew I had the potential to be like that, if you know what I mean? Like, did it choose me because I had that in me, does that now mean that I'm, like, scarred forever and darkened forever and have that potential to be like that again? Like I think Theo's a freaking idiot for being like, oh yeah, Void Styles, like, it's something you can just turn on. It's like, okay, you got another magic bug to infect him with or something?
Yeah.
Like, that's not how it works, Theo, but I feel like it does make Styles wonder about how, you know, what he has potential for. Yeah. The Nagitsune was a very, very, very stressful time for all
yes.
of us. But yeah, I'd like to just see if anyone has any thoughts on the Bad Moon Rising scene, particularly about whether Styles himself ever actually killed people with his own hands, if you know what I mean. He was certainly, like, the Nagitsune, you know, when Styles was being possessed, was certainly responsible for a lot of death. You know, not least Allison's, like when the Oni are on his side, and stuff like that. And the Oni have their swords and do a lot of damage, but I'm not sure if Styles ever does kill anyone, if you know what I mean. And that's what I'm the most curious about in that circumstance. Because I tried to trace through it and see, because I always thought he did. I was always under the impression that Styles, you know, or that the thing in Styles' body, while it was Styles and looking like Styles, had killed people. But I'm not sure. Do you have any clear memory of that?
No, it's, like I said, it's just a whole lot of dead bodies when I think back on it. And it's difficult because even when we were watching, it was very hard to tell exactly who was who. Not necessarily who was doing the killing, because we knew that was the Nagitsune, but even when we were looking at Styles, you kind of had to wonder, like, okay, is this Styles? Is this Void Styles pretending to be Styles? We don't actually know. And it got, I don't want to say convoluted because that sounds negative, but it got complicated and it got to the point where they almost became one person again. You almost couldn't tell necessarily like where one ended and the other began. And I think that in and of itself is very interesting.
Yeah, because it definitely like used him and like his memories and his like, you know, it made him sort of air his dark feelings and stuff as well. So, I don't know. In season 3, it's also when they discover Malia. And her, the fact that she sort of killed her mother and sister when turning into a coyote. And we, you know, then learn in season 5 it was because the desert wolf was, like, shooting at the car and Malia basically freaked out and started transforming without her, you know, control. And that culpability is never addressed except for deep guilt within Malia. And I don't know if this is just because it's all so supernatural, if you know what I mean, that it's, I did these things as a supernatural, therefore it's outside the law. Like, she's not being charged for murder or manslaughter, you know, whereas the Winter Soldier and Bucky, like, you know, for all that there are supernatural elements to the MCU, we're dealing with real world stuff, you know, that's definitely in the eyes of the law enforcement. It's not like a secret hidden society that people don't know about. Whereas Teen Wolf very much is, and Buffy very much is, but how Angel is dealing with his personal actions towards the people he's hanging around. You know, Malia's murdered some people. You know, is she ever held accountable for that? Legally, no, obviously. You know, she's held accountable to it by having blue eyes and by having a lot of guilt. Like, do you think that is, like, enough? Like, how would/should the show, like, address circumstances like this? You know, Derek killed a human girl. Like, who's, you know, what's happening there? Like, I mean, that was not while he was possessed, obviously, or outside of his own control. But just in terms of culpability, you know, there's massive questions to be asked about, you know, okay, what happens when all of these people die? Like, who is getting...
Yeah. I think it is very difficult, if not impossible, to apply human law to superhuman situations. And, I mean, it's kind of a silly example, but I think in a lot of ways Twilight got it right because they had that vampire council and those people that held vampires responsible for what they did, because obviously, they're outside of human law, not only because of what they're doing is, you know, incomprehensible to humans, but also because humans cannot track them down and beat them. They're too powerful to, you know, to succumb to them. But I think when you have other supernatural beings as the lawmakers and the law keepers, it adds another layer, because I think in some ways, like, no, Malia is not responsible for what happened to her, much in the same way that Scott, when we first see him turn in season 1, cannot control his actions. He obviously doesn't do anything nearly as bad as what Malia did, but at the same time, she's not responsible for losing control because she has no idea what's going on inside of her body, and she's kind of out of her own mind at that point. But in other situations, like, I think, you know, Gerard, for example, like, even though he is human, he is dealing in the supernatural. And I think somebody supernatural needs to hold him responsible for all of the terrible things
there
that he's done.
There must be, because there's, like, the crazy ward jail at Eichenhaus where they put Peter away. And then there's, like, the Calaveras or whatever they're called in there. Like, you know, they kept Kate, like, prisoner. Like, there's someone making calls, but I don't know if it's, like, a, you know, a collectively agreed upon body. You know, it's not a democracy or anything like that. I don't know. Twilight, can I just say, and I've always maintained this, has amazing world building, freaking phenomenal world building, in terms of their supernatural beings and the structure and everything about it. It's just the point of view characters are just, they need to die. That's all of the world building is fantastic in Twilight. I actually really love a lot of elements of, like, it's canon for the various creatures and stuff like that, but it's just the narrative that is not okay. Anyway.
That all-important narrative.
Yeah, moving on from that. Yeah, I don't know, like, Malia, you know, yeah, there's just not really much to be said, like, to hold accountable for those kind of situations about what you would... you know, about who there is to hold them accountable. Like, you know, Malia, we don't know whether, like, you know, say her father found out. We haven't had that kind of interaction of, like, you know, that would be the equivalent of, I guess, like, Tony and Bucky and Steve. We haven't had, like, does her dad know that she's a were-coyote and know that she, like, supernaturally killed her mother and sister? Was he in the car at the time as well? Like, I don't think he was. There has not been a lot of chances in the show to for people to be held accountable, or at least they also haven't taken the show to the level where anyone has done anything. Like, you know, none of these guys have, like, murdered a friend without, you know, being forgiven. I guess Aiden and Ethan did some really bad murdery stuff and then kind of got forgiven. And that wasn't even outside of their own minds. So, you know, like,
yeah,
these guys forgive pretty easy, it seems.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it has to do with guilt too. I mean, the more guilt you feel, the less you should be held accountable, because clearly you're holding yourself accountable. I mean, there's a huge difference between, like, what we're exploring right now on Buffy, between Buffy's reaction to Faith killing somebody, a person, and Faith's reaction to killing a person.
Yeah, if Bucky Barnes was walking around being like, that wasn't me, screw you, I want my, you know, 7 years back pay from the army and a private island, we would be like... sit down. Like, you know, like, we wouldn't be sympathetic if that's
no, possible, not at all.
Think. We might think that, you know, his sadness means that he deserves his 70 years of back pay in a private island. We have to want to give that to him, you know?
Right. Like, yeah. And so I think with Malia and everything in Styles, even though we see it less, we know that it's there. That guilt is very, very important. And even though Styles doesn't have his, you know, standing on a hilltop waiting for the sun to come up moment, I think it's apparent that they are still human enough to feel as though they did something wrong and want to make up for that. And, you know, even by the end of season 5, we see how much Styles enjoys helping people and wants to go into law enforcement. And I think that's critical in, yeah, not only us being sympathetic to them, but in them kind of skirting law and not being held accountable by going to jail or something like that. You know, it still makes it seem like they're okay.
I mean, that, and then, like, what Bucky ends up doing is, like, at least in the comic canon, and I guess Angel, I don't know, it feels like that whenever someone has something like this happen, that, you know, whether it's directly related or not, or whether it's, you know, whether it's due to their own guilt or no matter what, it kind of seems like they feel like they, you know, have to spend the rest of their life making up for it by, like, doing, you know, kind of putting more, what is it Natasha says in the Avengers, that, you know, like, putting, you know, more black in the ledger than red, you know, like putting, like putting more good into the world than they took out by being bad, I guess. And that, like, you know, That's a redemption thing for people who actively know that they did stuff badly. But for people who didn't have any control, like, I don't know, they often get, you know, they often have to pay back the world in the same way. And, you know, maybe it's good that they want to, but it's kind of sad that they have to.
Yeah. Quick question. I honestly don't know the answer to this. What about Black Widow? I mean, she was not brainwashed in the same way that Bucky was.
The movies haven't addressed it yet. In the in the comics, it's questionable, her training and brainwashing. The Black Widow program, it's more conditioning than outright brainwashing, if you know what I mean. It's more kind of, conditioning and really, abusive upbringing as opposed to frying their brain.
Yeah. Bucky so would you count that in the same way?
No, I wouldn't count it. It's certainly somewhere in the middle. And it's, you know, and it's certainly a lot of things were done to her without her control, but no, I would not count it in the same way of literally was not the brain driving the body, you know?
Right. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. So, do you want to talk a bit about like what's happened with Kira and whether this applies to her as well?
Yeah. This one's actually really interesting to me. And I kind of see this as a little bit of both, like a little bit of it being, you know how we were talking about Styles, this kind of thing was sort of like an outside factor, whereas, you know, Angels, for example, was definitely an inside factor, as is Bucky. In a lot of ways, it's something that you can't physically see the thing that, you know, comes out of them and is making them do these things. For Kira, it's a little bit of both, because on the one hand, she is being possessed by a Kitsune spirit, but at the same time, this spirit lives inside of her alongside her own human spirit. So it is very much still a part of her. And when that goes haywire, how much can you blame it on, you know, the actual spirit doing this and her inability to control that spirit? Because we see when it's starting to act up, like she does lose control over her body. She almost kills her mother, which clearly Kira would not have done otherwise. And she fights with Brett's sister in the locker room, and she's speaking Japanese, and she doesn't necessarily know what she's doing while she's doing it. And she almost kills like one of the chimeras, and I can't remember exactly if she was the one that killed that lady in Melissa's house, in the McCall house.
I don't know if that was meant to be a ruse or not, but
yeah.
It was definitely bad enough that it's ended up with her going off to live for 1,000 years in the desert with the skinwalkers, you know, like her lack of control and what she felt like she was owed, you know, what she felt like she owed the world to needed to do, if you know what I mean. Like, this is her, like, atonement, like, all of these people feel like they need to atone for what they've done, whether they were in control or not. Kira is certainly on an atonement path now.
Right. And unlike Styles, where you could pull that thing out of him and say, okay, the situation is fixed, this is very much the same way with Angel, in that she has to learn to live with this thing inside of her and constantly keep it in check. And, you know, after the things that she did, which, you know, obviously were not as bad as like what Angel's done or Styles has done, you know, people are still going to worry, is she going to lose control? Yeah. And how do you address that situation? Do you let her stay with you and, you know, hope that everything's going to be okay, also so you can keep an eye on her? Or do you send them away and say, look, we can't have you around here anymore because you're too much of a problem. We don't know what's going to happen with you. And I think because she goes off with the skinwalkers, it's, they're sending her away, but they're also sending her away to get better. It's not like it's, I mean, obviously we don't know right now, but it's not necessarily a permanent solution.
Yeah. And it's not exactly a punishment.
No. And she did it herself. You know, that was, she volunteered to do it. She didn't want to at first and then realized how important something like that would be for her and her ability to control her powers. So it was definitely something that she chose on her own, which in a situation like this, when all of your choices are taken away, is very good to have. It's very good that she chose to do it for herself.
And I think that that's a massive thing with Bucky as well. It's when you're in a circumstance where you're doing things out of your control, then, yeah, what you do with your choice is the most important thing, which is, I think, why Steve doesn't start throwing things at the wall when Bucky, you know, decides to refreeze himself, because he respects and knows the enormity of, you know, making that choice about what to do with yourself, with having like the autonomy over yourself again, which is, you know, what Kira is doing as well. So yeah, even if it's not the happiest of endings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
And then we haven't really seen the fallout yet of what it means for Mason, who, unlike Styles, unlike Kira, this is back to a Jackson level story of he killed a lot of people. Like, a lot of people. Or at least the Beast did, and the Beast was living in Mason when in human form, if you know what I mean. Like, Mason was this completely unknowing werewolf, but, you know, it was the host of the Beast. And then, you know, unlike Styles, like, you know, we don't quite know, like, with the Nagitsune, whether all of that killing got magically undone. As I said, I read a transcript which seems to claim that it did, but I'd have to watch the episode again to see what they were actually trying to make clear there. But this is, there's no going back from this. There is a huge pile of dead bodies killed by the Beast. And it didn't, you know, he's not necessarily going to be held accountable for this by the law. It didn't, you know, it wasn't Mason running around doing it in his own body. You know, that no one's
seen Mason
on CCTV killing people. But
that's
a bunch of people.
Yeah, that's a really interesting part to me, because much like Jackson, it's this other creature that has done it. It's not like Styles walking around killing people with, like, Scott and everybody knowing that it's not really Styles, but the rest of society not realizing that. Mason was never present, as far as I remember. It was always the Beast and him turning into the Beast, and he's very much just a vessel. It's not even his body, you know, doing those things. He's not even a weapon of himself, because he is human, but he's just a vessel for this being to come into fruition.
So we obviously haven't had any real, throwback, you know, any real handling of that, because it happened right at the end of the last season. But he's got a very high body count. Like, so, you know, whether it was him or whether it was, you know, what, however they want to count it, you know, if you're equating this to Jackson and the Kanema, his body count's massive. So do you think that, like, does he have any memory of being the Beast? Like, you know, he claims, you know how he claims to, like, not know what's going on, like that he has no knowledge of it. Did we end up sort of believing that, or was there questionable evidence about whether he was kind of lying about not?
I think he really did not know what was going on, and he had no idea, because he was continually trying to help everybody figure out who the Beast was. He was very much part of trying to solve that mystery. I wonder if kind of like, who was that? Was that Jackson? Was it somebody else? It's like when you realize what you've done, you kind of remember what you've done.
Yeah.
And if he will, because if he doesn't remember any of it, I think it's very easy for him to remove himself from that situation and not feel any guilt. If he remembers taking those lives, he's going to feel an incredible amount of guilt.
So that could be something that is addressed in future. But in terms of the show and culpability, I don't feel like that anyone is holding him accountable currently. You know, they're not, like, punishing him or making him atone for it. Like, you know, no one's doing that to him in the narrative currently. But, yeah, I'm curious as to whether this is going to have any effect on him in the future or if it's going to be sort of not something that was really him, like that it was just something that they move on from because it was not really him in any way, that it was just sort of, I don't know, borrowing him. It is a possession, like, that he gets. It's a very different circumstance. Like, they have done this in quite a few different ways on Teen Wolf, like, very varying, like, levels of how that whole possession / autonomy thing works. Like, there's been all sorts of different factors involved. But
yeah.
The season 6 is mind control, and it's like, have we not had enough mind control on Teen Wolf yet after everything we've just talked about? But, like, this is going to be even more. Like, if it's going to be mind control, does that mean we're going to have this circumstance to deal with more often? Like, people doing stuff, you know, while brainwashed? Like, is that what we're going to be talking about?
We honestly have no idea what this entails. And I'm very curious to see not only how they handle it, but who ends up being mind controlled. Because I think that for a very, very, very long time, Scott has been sort of untouchable. And if he is the one who ends up doing some really terrible things, how he and the other people around him handle it. Because obviously, yes, you know, like we've been saying, it'll be...
They also had that with Scott and the Berserker as well, but it was for like 5 minutes.
Yeah. It clearly will not be his fault, as we just spent like 2 hours talking about. But at the same time, if his body, if his face is the one that's doing terrible things, it is still very difficult to get over that, like we saw with Giles and Angel. So, I don't know. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of different ways that this could go, and we just don't know anything yet. But I'm very curious to see what it's going to be like and how they handle it and who the actual bad guys are.
Yeah, I wish we could say more about that, but we know, like, literally nothing. So, that's, yeah. I guess sort of the final thing just to address quickly is whether werewolves at the full moon, like, count under what we've been talking about with this accountability thing. Like, on Buffy, they definitely do count in terms of, like, you know, they're always like, Oz is, you know, it wasn't you, wasn't the real you, you know, you're an innocent, you know, like, and stuff like that. And they lock him in the cage and, like, he's out of control, completely mindless and not in control, and that he's, even if he did kill someone in the woods, that it wasn't really him. Whereas on this show, you know, the werewolves are much more developed in that, you know, yeah, at first, like, when someone doesn't have any experience, like, in werewolfing, they kind of lose control. But the whole arc of the show has been about, like, control, and now even, you know, full moon doesn't really seem, it's not like they have to lock themselves up every month. I mean, Liam does sometimes, but yeah, it's sort of, in general, all the werewolves are kind of, it's just a matter of how much you make an effort, kind of, I guess, or how much you learn, how, you know, the skills necessary, or I don't know if it just comes down to, like, strength of personality or something. But given that they can learn to control it, do you think that there is, you know, case for this being the same circumstance, or, you know, is it sort of a bit different because they do have their own minds, I guess, at the time?
I think it depends on when it takes place, because there definitely is a difference between Teen Wolf and Buffy in that Buffy's werewolves lack humanity. They are an animal. It's not Oz in there. And not only is it not Oz, it doesn't even look like Oz. Whereas on Teen Wolf, like, it very much still looks like the people. And you, I mean, I keep going back to Scott, who was chained up to the radiator when Styles, like, pours the water in the dog bowl and stuff. And it just, that's also not Scott. It looks like Scott, and he's much less animalistic, but his animal instincts are still, like, his animal instincts are stronger, but he's still human.
Yeah, like, and you know, part of that kind of affected behavior is, like, you know, saying really mean stuff. Like, it's not like, it's so, for me, I don't know, it's kind of less of a, you know, the Oz situation is very cut and dried, and with the werewolves in Teen Wolf, it's not. It's kind of like, yes, maybe like someone's first moon out when they're like, they have no one to help them and they are, you know, completely running around oblivious, then there might be a case for it. But like, if you kind of know what the deal is with being a werewolf and then sort of don't make the effort to be, you know, learn what it takes to be controlled, I don't feel like it's the same circumstance as being completely innocent of your actions. I don't know.
Yeah,
but then there are some people who just really, you know, that it's too much for them. I don't know.
Yeah, honestly, like, it's kind of like being an angry drunk. Like,
yes,
it's still you, but you kind of can't control what's coming out of your mouth. It's things that maybe you wouldn't have said otherwise, and maybe not even necessarily believe, but just happen to think every once in a while and feel like crap because, you know, that thought crossed your mind. But you don't necessarily have control over it unless you learn to stop drinking.
Do that. Yeah, that's a very good comparison, actually. So, yeah, I think that's sort of how I feel about that in that case. I'm just going to have a quick read of a couple of tweets. I tweeted about this a little while ago when we were going to record about 2 weeks ago before I got sick and you got sick. And yeah, I just had a few here. Just let me get to them. And then, you know, in the meantime, yeah, there's definitely quite a few examples of this. Like, these are obviously not the only examples of them in fiction. We kind of talked about it on Hyperball group chat as well. And, you know, some of the biggest ones were, like, the Hunger Games with Peter. He's not as outright brainwashed, but he's definitely, like, been, like, some, you know, conditioning. Ginny with Tom Riddle in Harry Potter is a straight-up possession where she loses time. Supernatural apparently does this all the time, though I've never seen any. And then Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has had a lot of it as well, which is I think the way Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. handles a lot of the issues is fairly questionable, and I don't really know who the good guys are anymore. But you obviously do a lot of Once Upon a Time stuff, and their, like, lead protagonist had an issue like that. Is that right?
Yeah, she became the Dark One, and even though Emma, as the Dark One, which is, like, this super powerful evil being, she was still very much herself and still in control in a lot of ways, but kind of let some morally gray things, like, slip through. And so, whereas she wouldn't necessarily do that on her own, in this case, she kind of, like, let it slide. So that example, I think, is a little complicated and layered, but one that is pretty straightforward is that people in the show, or especially ones with magic, have the ability to pull out the hearts of other people, and instead of killing them, it actually looks cool because it, like, glows, and it doesn't really look like a heart. It's like plastic, basically. But instead of it killing them, it allows you to control them. So you speak into the heart and they hear it in their head, and then they can either say what you're telling them to say or do what you're telling them to do. And it is very much mind control. I mean, 100%, they are not responsible for their actions because you are able to control every part of them.
Gross. Really gross.
Yeah. It's kind of weird.
Okay, so a couple of feedback tweets about this issue. One from Cassandra, whose Twitter is Palliard, said, "A difficult problem. Victims can't be expected to forgive, for example, Giles and Angel. A TV show will want us to forgive so the show can go on without a lot of intrusive angst. Life is different. And then all suspicion about culpability must be allayed before forgiveness can occur," which I think is true, like, and I think is what you're saying about, like, you know, why Bucky wants to do that to himself, you know, like, why he wants to be frozen and fixed, like, you know, and stuff like that. to prove, I guess, that he is okay. With Angel, there isn't really any proof at the moment, like, and especially the fact that he's, like, dating Buffy again and people are worried about that. So, yeah. Carol, who is Carol Abu Saab, says, I'm team always forgive them, though I still want the story to explore the effect of their actions on others and themselves, which, yes, is true. I think that's how we all feel. And then Victoria, whose I loves music, said, Jessica Jones is a huge example. It's basically what the entire season is about with Kilgrave's mind control. I haven't seen that show. Is that true? Or does he actually do mind control, or is he just like a manipulative bastard?
He absolutely does mind control. Like, okay. 100% has the ability to force people to do things against their will.
Okay. And how does that get handled?
That is really interesting. I don't know why I wasn't thinking about this before, but his superpower literally is to control other people, and they will do whatever he tells them to do. And I think the narrative, especially through Jessica, explores the fact that these people are not responsible for what they've done. But at the same time, Jessica, who has gone through this, is very, very, very guilty about one thing in particular that she's done. And wow, even though she knows, yeah, and there's even this question of, well, was it while she was under his control? We don't necessarily know. And I think that show is very dark and very good at kind of exploring difficult topics. And it's really interesting. You should definitely watch it. I like the show a lot.
I just didn't get the chance. Like, when they put out like those all at once seasons, I very rarely get the chance to catch up on them as quickly as everyone like watches them all at once. Especially because we don't really have Netflix here. Like, it's
right.
Yeah. It's really difficult, but yeah, good to know. So is there anything else you wanted to kind of say about this? Do you feel, you know, differently or more strongly about anything in terms of this issue?
No, I feel pretty much the same, to tell you the truth. I think that it's, you know, really important to acknowledge that people who are either possessed or have been mind controlled are not responsible for their actions, but at the same time, you can't erase what the victims have gone through, especially when it was their face and their body that was doing those things. And I really like when it is complicated and not easy to decide, like, who's right, who's wrong, what to do next. I think that Buffy in particular is doing that really well where we are right now. And I think that even like Bucky's storyline is also very good because people want to hold him responsible, even though he's not necessarily responsible. So the darker and the less clean it is, I think the more interesting it makes the story.
Yeah. Yeah. And at this point, I'm just curious whether, you know, it will be a factor in Teen Wolf if the whole season is going to be about mind control. So,
yeah.
That's why I wanted to sort of talk about that in relation to these big deal things that we've been putting our energy into while Teen Wolf's been not here, basically. So the timing is quite good, actually, for all of those things to have been happening at the same time, like that we were up to this particular part in Buffy and that the Captain America movie came out and that we have mind control coming up on Teen Wolf. So this was a good topic, I think, to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. All right. Well, on that note, I suppose we will leave you and we will update you as soon as we know any news about, you know, actual Teen Wolf. But yeah, please let us know if there's like any good examples, like to continue this conversation about culpability. If you have any examples of like shows or movies or books that handle this like in a certain way that you love or that you hate, you know, please don't like send us real hate, but like if you've got some conversations to be had, it's a topic that we're really interested in, so yeah, feel free to get in touch. Yeah, in the meantime, hopefully you've enjoyed this, and yeah, let us know if there's anything, any other sort of themes that we could talk about in this manner in terms of like you know, other media compared to Teen Wolf and certain themes and handling of situations, because this was actually quite fun. So yeah, in the meantime, we'll say bye-bye and see you later. So bye-bye.
Bye.
No, don't sign me into Goodreads, for fuck's sake. Okay, all right.